From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today is National Coming Out Day. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, what it was like to be gay before the gay rights movement. We feature an interview with two mothers of the movement, Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin. They co-founded the first national lesbian group, the Daughters of Bilitis. Jane Rule will tell us what it was like to write novels with lesbian characters back in 1964. Her first novel was later adapted into the film Desert Hearts. Historian and gay rights activist Martin Duberman remembers some of his experiences looking for a therapy that could cure him of homosexuality. And we'll end the show with post-Stonewall comic Leah Delaria, who says don't call her a lesbian because she's a dyke. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Federal agents working with law enforcement authorities around the world have cracked a major drug trafficking ring involving Nigerian nationals. Attorney General Janet Reno praised the meticulous work of the investigators who broke the case.
2 1-ounce undercover buys of heroin in Milwaukee by DEA agents led to a court-authorized wiretap on a phone in Chicago earlier this year. In turn, that has since led to the interception of more than 25,000 phone conversations, the seizure of more than 55 kilograms of heroin, and criminal charges against 44 involved in this global heroin ring.
Reno says the smuggling ring was unique in the size and scope of its operations, which reached from Southeast Asia to a number of American cities, including Boston, Chicago, Detroit, and Milwaukee. Law enforcement officials say the FBI has arrested 5 members of a West Virginia militia group for plotting to blow up an FBI facility. Jim Wallace of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
Officials say the 5 members of the Mountaineer Militia plan to place explosives near the FBI fingerprint records facility near Clarksburg, West Virginia. That facility houses the agency's fingerprint files and crime statistics reporting center. It opened last August and will eventually employ about 2,600 people. The militia members are in FBI custody in Clarksburg. Federal officials plan to release more information about the arrests this afternoon. The Mountaineer Militia claims to have 37 members. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Wallace in Charleston, West Virginia.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin says he's creating an emergency commission to collect unpaid taxes. He told Russians that overdue taxes are mainly responsible for the government's inability to pay public workers. From Moscow, NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Speaking in his weekly radio address from the sanatorium where he's preparing for heart surgery, Yeltsin said he sympathizes with the thousands of government employees who've gone without pay for months. He used the example of one of the country's leading scientists, Vladimir Strakhov, who went on a hunger strike last week to protest the lack of funding for his institute. But Yeltsin said Strakhov's hunger strike is not the government's fault. His fate is on your conscience, he told tax evaders. Yeltsin said the new tax commission will be headed by Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin and Chief of Staff Anatoly Chubais, and will have authority over both taxes and customs. Cheating on taxes is widespread in Russia, but many Russians believe their tax money is routinely misused by corrupt government officials. I'm Andy Bowers in Moscow.
Prices at the wholesale level rose just 0.2% last month. Retail sales registered their biggest gain in 4 months, but the offsetting effect of those two reports was seen as further evidence that the economy is slowing gradually, and that has sparked a rally on Wall Street, where the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 45 points. This is NPR News. Just 3 days after being named one of the winners of this year's Nobel Prize for Economics, Columbia University professor William Vickery has died. The university says Vickery collapsed last night while driving to an academic conference in Boston. He was 82 years old. This year's Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to 2 human rights activists in East Timor. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
Carlos Bello, Bishop of East Timor, and José Ramos Horta, a leader of the East Timorese independence movement, are the winners of the 1996 Nobel Peace Prize. They were cited by the Nobel Committee for their work towards a just and peaceful solution to the conflict of East Timor along the Pacific Rim. Indonesia invaded the eastern part of the island of Timor in 1975 and established a harsh military regime, which has led to allegations of genocide. Thousands of East Timorese have been killed resisting Indonesian rule. Bishop Bello has come to embody the struggle of the East Timorese to regain their independence. Jose Ramos Horta lives in exile in Sydney, Australia, and is seen as the main spokesman for the East Timorese cause. In awarding the pair the Peace Prize, the Nobel Committee is clearly trying to focus world attention on an often ignored conflict. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
A demolition crew in Jacksonville, Florida, aimed a wrecking ball at the wrong building in a shopping center and sent a roof crashing down on three people, including a four-year-old boy who is in critical but stable condition. Witnesses say the crew was tearing down a vacant store. The wrecking ball hit an adjacent store that had shoppers inside. The Commerce Department says it has reached a tentative agreement with Mexican tomato growers to settle a bitter trade dispute. The complaint was brought by tomato farmers in Florida who claim Mexican growers were selling produce in the U.S. at below market prices and costing domestic growers hundreds of millions of dollars. Under the settlement, Mexican growers agree not to sell their tomatoes at less than a reference price that will be adjusted annually. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is National Coming Out Day. On this archive edition, we feature interviews about what it was like to be gay before Stonewall and the gay rights movement. Back in 1955, Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin co-founded the first national lesbian group in America, the Daughters of Bilitis. Lyon and Martin are now considered mothers of the gay rights movement. The Daughters of Bilitis was created as an alternative to the gay bar scene, but developed into an activist group. Martin is 75 now, Lyon is 72. They've been a couple for 43 years. They both served as delegates to the 1995 White House Conference on Aging. The Daughters of Bilitis disbanded in the 70s, but Martin and Lyon have remained outspoken advocates of gay rights. In 1992, I asked them if they knew there was such a thing as a lesbian when they started having feelings toward women.
No.
No.
Sexuality was not talked about in those days, and let alone homosexuality.
Yeah, we're talking way back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and I didn't really find out about lesbians until I met Del, actually.
And what year was that?
That was in
1949,
right. And I knew vaguely that there were such things as male homosexuals, but that was about it. But when I look back, I know that I was always fascinated with women. I just didn't have a clue as to what to do about that.
Del, what about you? What was the first time that you had a sense that you felt things toward other women?
Oh, when I was about 10 or 12, and I, figured that I was different and I was the only one.
The only one in the world?
The only one in the world. That's a story we hear over and over again in our age group. Everybody thought, oh, I'm the only one.
Well, you got married when you were 19. Did you
Right. Did
you do that in spite of thinking that you were different?
Well, at that particular time, there was no woman that I was particularly attracted to, and so I thought maybe that was over with.
Where did you each find out more about other lesbians, about the fact that you weren't alone? Did you turn to books? Did you turn to other people?
Well, there really weren't any books except, you know, unless you went to the first you had to know the word homosexual or lesbian in order to look anything up.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was nothing that was any good in the libraries in those early days.
And mostly it just told you how sick you were.
So it frightened you when you found the books, actually.
Right. There's no way that we could identify with that. I think the first book that I read that helped me out was Radcliffe Hall's book.
The Well of Loneliness, yeah.
You both read that?
No, I didn't. Somehow or other I missed that, so that I was I was through college and working before I found out about lesbians, and that was only because it was about 1949 that Del and I and another woman we worked with were having drinks at the press club in Seattle. after work, and somehow or other the subject came up, and Del said she was a lesbian, and I was fascinated because I'd never met one before, I thought. And the first thing I did when I got home was call everybody I knew and tell them.
Tell them about Del?
Yeah. I didn't know that that was a bad thing. Fortunately, it had no repercussions to speak of.
Yeah, talk about outing.
Talk about naivete.
So, Phyllis, did you get the feeling right away that, well, you know, maybe you were too? Did that strike you?
Not right at the moment. We had already become pretty close friends, Del and I. And then, of course, I was curious. But one of the things I had discerned about myself was that in my relationships with men, what I was doing was, in essence, sort of chasing after the ones I was interested in. And then when I caught them, as it were, then I became disinterested. And I was kind of afraid that the same thing would happen if I chased after Del. So I didn't do anything for quite a while, as a matter of fact.
Then she was going to leave town and...
For good.
And so it was... Then or never.
Who made the first move?
I did, but as Phyllis says, I made a pass and she completed it.
She sort of made a half pass.
How did you both meet?
On the job. We were working for trade publications in Seattle.
And you knew each other from working together?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Well, it was... I was working in Seattle before, and then the boss told us all that he had this gay divorcee coming from San Francisco.
He didn't know how gay.
And so, I was fascinated because I had lived in San Francisco. I went to UC Berkeley, and I had lived partially in San Francisco, and it was great to know somebody from down there was coming up.
Del, you had already been married. What happened to end the marriage?
I fell in love with a woman next door, my feelings were really awakened by then, and I just felt I needed to do something about it.
When you started being a couple, a lot of lesbian relationships were in the kind of butch femme mode. Was your relationship that way too early on?
Well, it was sort of, yeah. I think that it didn't really stay that way very long, although to all intents and purposes, we were still a butch femme couple in public. Since Della decided, when I met her, I decided she was a butch, I didn't have much of an option. So I became a femme. I've often thought I would have made a really good butch. And besides which, I did all of the butch kind of things. If you will, I mean, I drive and Del doesn't, and I can drive a nail in and she can't, and, you know, stuff like that. But we conformed to what the going thing was outside the home, but not certainly didn't do it when we were at home.
Yeah, I was a sissy butch.
Yeah.
So there was pressure on you. You felt that, like, I mean, from what you knew about lesbian couples, this is the way it had to be. This is the way it was supposed to be. Butch and
femme. That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's how everybody was doing it. Because at that point in time, the only model anybody had was mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody was kind of following that.
Yeah, and when we first got together, I had a job that I had lined up before I came to... Down back to San Francisco from Seattle, and Phyllis would get up and make me breakfast, which I didn't like to eat in those days. That didn't last very long.
That's what my mother had always done, right? She had always gotten up and gotten Dad's breakfast. So I thought, well, this is what you have to do. But as Del said, it didn't last very long.
Well, when did you
so
give
I didn't
it up?
Like doing it either.
Hmm? When did you give it up?
Oh, probably within a month.
Oh, that quickly. So.
Oh, I think so.
Oh, yeah, at least. Yeah,
that might have been sooner.
Well, how did you bring it up with each other, that you're going to change and that you weren't going to conform to that standard anymore?
I don't think we really talked about it. We just sort of acted like ourselves.
Phyllis, how do you think the relationship was changed when you decided to give up those roles?
Well, I think what happened was that we just became the people that we had when we became friends. We didn't really deal with those kinds of roles because I was supposedly Del's straight friend anyway. So we were on a different kind of footing. Then when we became lovers, there was this sudden switch from, you know, masculine, feminine. She was supposed to be the aggressor and all these kinds of things. And I think then we just wandered back to being the people that we actually were, which was neither the aggressor nor the non-aggressor.
My guests are the co-founders of the group The Daughters of Bilitis, the first national lesbian organization in America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon are my guest. You met in 1949. In 1955, you co-founded Daughters of Bilitis. Why did you feel you wanted to start some kind of organization? And what did you have in mind when you started it? What did you want it to be? What did you need it to be?
Well, it wasn't our idea, but we had met a lesbian through a couple of gay men that lived around the corner from us. And she called us one morning, Saturday morning, and said, how would you like to join with us in a social club for lesbians? And we were just delighted because we didn't know any, and we were so starved for socializing with other lesbians that we jumped at the chance. What Daughters of Bilitis started out to be was a very secret lesbian social club.
Where did the name come from, Daughters of Bilitis?
From the Songs of Bilitis by Pierre Louis, which is a long lesbian narrative poem.
It's a poem you knew?
The lesbian who invited us to join the club had read the book, and she offered that as a suggestion for the name of it.
She thought that lesbians would know what Bilitis meant, but nobody else would. I don't think that was true, because I don't think most lesbians knew about the Songs of Bilitis. However, it worked out as a name.
It was supposed to be a secret, and we have spent many, many years now trying to explain the name.
So I guess it worked pretty well. You know, some people, when they hear the name, think it sounds like a disease, Bilitis.
Well, that's why we pronounced it Bilitis.
Instead of Bilitis, like phlebitis?
Instead of Bilitis, because we didn't want it to sound like a disease. And that was at the time, you know, when Eisenhower had ileitis, and so we said, no, it's got to be Bilitis, so it doesn't sound like an illness.
So you were trying to keep the organization, you know, very, very secret to protect the members. Were there ways that lesbians could let other lesbians know who they were, like little cues lesbians could give each other through the way they dressed or wore their hair or whatever?
Well, I think that's probably why so many lesbians dress pretty butchy, to let others know that here's a possibility.
Did you go to the bars at all before or after you co-founded Daughters of Bilitis?
Oh, yeah.
What was the bar scene like then?
Well, what was it like? It was, for many lesbians, it was the only outlet. It was the only place they had to go where they could be themselves. It was the only place they knew to go to meet other lesbians, for sure, you know, without being, you know, perhaps making a costly mistake. And it's true there was a lot of drinking, and which is what goes on in bars. But it was the only place. It was the only
And it was a risky place.
Yeah.
Because periodically there would be police raids. And one of the things that we worked through on that one was during the Daughters of Belitis, when we started to have public
discussion meetings.
And we got attorneys to come and talk to us and tell us our rights. And what we found when a bar raid took place, that most everybody pleaded guilty and to a plea of disturbing the peace or visiting a house of ill repute or whatever to get out of it and pay a fine. But in actuality, what they were pleading guilty to was being gay, because they hadn't done anything that was illegal in these places. They were just there. So when we found an attorney who said, just plead nulla contendere, so you were there. And then when the police officer was asked, you know, what we did or in the bars, all I could say was they just rounded us all up. And there was nothing that the court could do but let us go. When I say us, I'm talking about lesbians in general. Phyllis and I never got caught up in a raid. We missed one by a day, another by a week, but we didn't get caught up. But we did find legal help for those who did.
Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon co-founded the Daughters of Belitis. Our interview was recorded in 1992. Lyon and Martin spoke about how difficult to impossible it was to find books in the 1950s to help them understand their own sexual orientation. Just a few years later, they could have read a novel by Jane Rule. Rule's first novel, Desert of the Heart, was about a woman who, after divorcing her husband, fell in love with another woman. The book was later adapted into the movie Desert Hearts. Rule has written about lesbian themes in subsequent novels, short stories, and essays. Although born in New Jersey, Vancouver, Canada has been Rule's home since 1956. Last year, a film about Rule won the Audience Choice Award for Best Documentary at the San Francisco Lesbian and Gay Film Festival. In 1988, I asked Rule if she was out when Desert of the Heart was published in 1964.
You have to remember that in those days you didn't talk about things like that. Certainly among my friends and my family I was, but I was teaching at the University of British Columbia at the time, and someone did bring up the issue after the book came out. And the defense in the department was, you don't have to be a murderer to write murder mysteries. And I think this is a very silly defensiveness, but in 1964, not surprising.
The stakes were really much higher then. There was no gay and lesbian movement. The stakes were much higher, I think, to admit to yourself or to anyone else that you were gay.
Well, it's not very hard to admit if you're in a very happy relationship. In fact, it's something to celebrate, so that it didn't seem to me anything humiliating, just awkwardly private. So that there were social problems about it. You know, we kept being invited to dinner parties with two gay men so that it would all look all right. And it was a totally open secret. But, I mean, you simply dealt in those terms in those days. I got much more restless much earlier than most people, I suppose, and then found myself the only open lesbian in Canada, and therefore any time an issue came up, I had to address it. So I became a kind of spokesperson for no movement, because there wasn't anybody else out there.
Well, how did you feel being thrust into that role?
Sometimes irritated. I don't really feel that my chief job is educating the world about lesbianism, or that it should be necessary, but obviously it is. And I think if you're put on the spot, the one thing you can do about it is to be educative as you can be.
I would suspect that your readers write you very emotional letters. I'm thinking especially of readers who were first coming out as they started reading you, and it's so exciting to find characters in fiction whose lives reflect in some way your life, and gays have been so marginalized, especially in the past, in our culture, that it's just been impossible to find images of people who were gay. And if you find it, it can be so exciting. So I'm sure you've gotten very personal letters from readers who really wanted to make some kind of emotional contact with you. But it's really hard for an author to pay back emotionally, you know, in the same way that a reader would write in. How have you handled that?
I think it was most difficult for me when Desert of the Heart came out, because, of course, that was a little book out there all by itself without any other books for people to turn to. When you get a letter from a distressed reader, or a reader who feels you're the only person in the whole world who understands them, there really isn't very much you can do. You know, when someone is writing you from South America saying they're about to kill themselves and only you can help, it's horrifying. And I think that it was the greatest burden to me after that book came out. I don't get as many distressed letters anymore. I get many more happy, celebrating letters, which are much easier to deal with.
When you were young, did you look for literature that had some evidence of homosexuality in it?
No, I read The Well of Loneliness when I was a kid and was horrified by it.
What horrified you?
Well, I thought, I'm going to have to live in a ghetto and dress up like a man. And I was already 6 feet tall with a deep voice, so, you know, it's just... And I couldn't speak French, and apparently the only people who knew each other were people who lived in Paris, and the whole thing just turned me off completely. And there was nothing else. But I didn't really look in literature for much of anything. I really, when I was a kid, thought that novels did an awful lot of lying about how people really felt. I didn't really understand that they were making social comments. I mean, I knew perfectly well that children didn't die so that we would be better people, as they do in Dickens, and I was very suspicious of literature, perhaps because I didn't find people or feelings that I could much identify with.
Well, then what made you want to write?
To tell the truth. Somebody had to.
Writer Jane Rule, recorded in 1988. More on what it was like to be gay before the gay rights movement in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, historian and gay rights activist Martin Duberman looks back on the 50s and 60s when he tried to become a heterosexual through so-called conversion therapy. Then, the kind of humor that couldn't have been performed before the gay rights movement, we'll hear from Leah Delaria. Thank you.
Band.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is National Coming Out Day, and on this archive edition of our show, we're featuring interviews about what it was like to be gay before the gay rights movement. Martin Duberman came of age when psychiatrists still considered homosexuality a pathology, and he believed them. He went into therapy, seeking a cure that could end the desires he was unable to repress. Duberman's memoir, Cures, told his story about being gay in the 1950s and 60s, trying unsuccessfully to change who he was. His latest book, Midlife Queer, follows his story through the 70s. The recent movie Stonewall was based on his oral history, Stonewall. Duberman's parents first sent him to a therapist when he was 15. They didn't know he was gay. I asked Duberman what his parents perceived as his problem.
Well, they knew that outside the house, I was very gregarious. I tended to be a leader, and I was certainly articulate. And in the house, I was monosyllabic. All they could get out of me was, you know, a grunt, yes or no, at dinner. They had no idea what was wrong, and they thought a therapist might.
Now, you went to see this therapist. It was on your mind, right, that you knew you were different from heterosexuals in some in some fundamental way, but you weren't going to tell your psychiatrist about it.
No, not that first one. I wasn't going to tell anybody. I was barely telling myself. I was sort of semi-conscious of my sexuality. And that's one reason I think I was silent around the house. I didn't want anybody to begin to get near me so that they might learn my terrible secret. And that first therapist, I can remember I disliked him on sight and didn't trust him at all. And his cure, the first of many, was that I should go home, throw my arms around my mother, and tell her I loved her. I mean, literally, that was his cure. And I did it. I tended to do everything I was told for a while until my rebelliousness belatedly surfaced. But I did it. You know, and the poor woman was enormously thrilled and excited, you know, and cried and said, I knew it would all turn out all right. And I thought to myself, oh, this is terrible. This is grotesque. Anyway, that was a fairly short-term set of visits because she reported to the therapist that, wonderful, you've cured him. And so that he loves me. So that was the end of that therapy.
So it showed you how superficial some of these signs of success could be.
Oh, yeah. Well, I never talked to that therapist about my vague feelings that I was homosexual.
Now, you later went into therapy yourself. You decided to go to therapy. What got you into therapy that second time?
Well, the second time was in the mid-50s when I was in graduate school at Harvard, and I was in a love affair, which had helped a lot in making me more comfortable with being who I was. I mean, there's nothing like the magic of love to think, I really am okay, even though I'm not following society's dictates. But our relationship, like all relationships, started to have some problems after a couple of years. And instead of assuming that these could be worked out, we bought the culture's message, which was, anybody who is homosexual is incapable of intimacy, incapable of sustained long-term commitment. And having internalized all of that, we felt, well, these aren't run-of-the-mill problems with a relationship. These instead are symptoms of an underlying condition which makes all significant relating impossible. So I dutifully, you know, trooped into a therapist's office again.
And how long did it take for you to tell him that you were gay?
I think I told him right away because I came the second time. By then I was in my mid-20s, I guess. The second time I came with a clear purpose to change my sexual orientation, because the problems in the love affair had convinced me that if I stayed homosexual, I'm using homosexual because that's the word we used then, that there was no chance for happiness. So I arrived with a clear agenda, you know, make me straight.
Now, this was still in the days when homosexuality was seen as a pathology within the psychiatric profession.
Entirely. There was no dissent in those years. That's why almost everyone of my generation did internalize the message, because there were no counter-messages. There were a few people who were beginning to do work, like preeminently Evelyn Hooker in the late 50s. She had, what happened in that case, and she lived in California and she knew a lot of gay men, and none of them were in therapy. They were quite content with their lives, and they finally said to her, look, you've got to do a study on us. You know, the only studies to date are studies of people who are miserable and therefore seek therapeutic help. And she did. And just as those gay men had predicted, the results turned out to be, these are people who are very content with their lives and very well adjusted. And she did all kinds of blind studies and comparisons. And, you know, they cannot be detected if you compare them with heterosexual men. The same kinds of lives in terms of contentment or lack of it. But in any case, they can't be separated out. That was a beginning. But Evelyn Hooker's early studies appeared in very technical journals. And it was many years before those studies really hit the mainstream.
When you told your psychiatrist that you were homosexual and it was making you unhappy, did he think he had a cure for you?
Absolutely.
And what was it?
Part of the message of those years was not only, I mean, the first part was homosexuality is pathology. The second part was this particular pathology can be cured. And he had no doubt, nor did my later therapist in the 60s have any doubt, but that if I had the requisite will, and that was important, if I really wanted to change, they could all but guarantee the results.
I love that because it puts the ball back in your court.
Exactly.
You know? And if you can't become a heterosexual, it ain't my fault, it's your fault.
That's it. Well, that's the tyranny of therapy. I mean, the issue that arises is never the therapist's issue or the therapist's problem. It's always something the patient is doing wrong. That's why it can so easily be a form of fascism.
So what were some of the cures that your psychiatrist suggested could convert you from homosexuality to a more normal heterosexuality?
Well, the first step was I had to, as they put it, stop my acting out.
Meaning
I had to stop all homosexual contact. That first therapist in the mid-50s, instead of helping me to clarify the issues between me and the man I was in love with, who I call Larry in the book, instead of doing that, which is what a good therapist would do today, he told me immediately I had to break off the relationship with Larry, that it was a form of acting out, that this was how my underlying anxiety expressed itself. So the first step is you close the escape hatch, you stop acting out, then the anxiety surfaces, and you're able to analyze it. And as a result of the analysis, you then move toward that glorious end product we call heterosexuality.
Did you break off the relationship?
I did. I then broke off the therapy. I mean, I kept going back and forth. I was utterly ambivalent and torn. It was a ghastly couple of years.
My guest is historian and gay rights activist Martin Duberman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Back with Martin Duberman, his memoir, Cures, was about being gay in the 50s and 60s when he went to psychiatrists hoping to find a cure for his homosexuality. Now, what's another cure that you were given?
Well, in the 60s, when I started therapy with Carl, and the center of the book is about that therapy, I was encouraged to date. And in that therapy, I was in group therapy. So I was encouraged to get close, at least during group sessions, with the women in that group. And every time, you know, I would report back that I had at least enjoyed an evening with a female friend or a date. I mean, the therapist would, you know, cry the equivalent of Hosanna. It's, you see, it's taking. You know, the magic is taking. Any day now or in a year, you're going to make the final transition.
Would he push you to try to have sexual encounters with women to prove to yourself that you could do it?
Not overtly. And what continued to discourage all my therapists was that I never developed any erotic feelings for women. I never fantasized about them. I never had dreams about them. I have always been one of those people who's, for whatever reasons, is exclusively gay. You know, I'm a Kinsey 6, that scale, you know. 0 to 6, 0 is exclusively straight, and 6 is exclusively gay. And I've always been a 6. I pushed myself a little earlier in my life. You know, I tried to have sex, everything from the proverbial visit to the whorehouse to trying to have sex with my prom dates, but it never worked for me.
Did your psychiatrist ever get into trying to analyze the reasons for your homosexual, your relationship with your parents, or, you know, things from your past that must be responsible for this aberrant behavior?
Oh, yeah. Again, there was a decided party line in those years. I mean, the psychiatric profession was uniform in its ideology, and that ideology said that a certain kind of family configuration will produce, in my case, a gay son. They had a reverse theory for a lesbian daughter. And what the family configuration was, you know, a strong, overpowering, suffocating mother in combination with an absent or a distant or a hostile father. Irving Bieber, the psychoanalyst, wrote a book in 1962 called Homosexuality, which became the Bible of the profession. It seemed to confirm that configuration, which I just described. In fact, and it became, you know, I mean, he was showered with awards and he was an eminent figure. In fact, it's a very shoddy study, though that only became clear, you know, 10 years later.
In all the cures that you were exposed to, were you ever trying behavioral conditioning?
Fortunately, no, though that was also rampant in those years and right through the 60s. What they would do in terms of a gay man again, they would put the man on an electric grid. They would stand him on it, and then they would flash pictures of naked men or men with erections, and then they would give the patient a shock. And, of course, that induces a certain amount of aversion to same-gender sexuality. You can produce certain kinds of behavioral changes in people. Masters and Johnson have another form of this. But what you don't change is they're in a fantasy life. You don't change, really, the direction of their erotic lust. So what you're producing, in essence, is a kind of schizophrenia. You're producing a great disparity between the inner life and the outer behavior.
Of all the things that your psychiatrist suggested that you do, what do you think was the most damaging to you to participate in?
Well, I'm not sure participate, but I think what was most damaging to me was the negative self-image that it engendered in me. I mean, the way I saved my life finally was, and I was very lucky I was able to, I developed as a mechanism for coping with anxiety and self-hate, I developed into a kind of workaholic. I kept busy, 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 and to this day, I still keep busy.
I think people always wonder when they hear stories about psychiatrists who are, who maybe have good intentions, but have techniques that are going to end up being more damaging than anything else. People wonder, why did you submit to him? Why did you follow through on something that so went against your nature and what you must have known in your gut? Let me ask you about why you followed through on what the psychiatrist suggested, even though it really went against the grain for you, and even though you really didn't trust him very much in a lot of ways.
I think, though, to grow up in this country in those years, and to some extent still, you become homophobic yourself. You kind of take it in with your pablum in the morning. I mean, it's so therefore, when you get that kind of, you know, official expert opinion saying you are a sickie, what it does is it confirms your own negative feelings about yourself, which pre-exist if you're a gay person or a lesbian. And I had a hell of a time working my way out of that, because all those negative messages eventually form a kind of imprinting. It's hard to believe something opposite, something more positive.
When did you decide to leave conventional therapy?
It wasn't until 1970. And I left finally because there had been a lot percolating, thanks to the wonderful 60s, which can't return too soon, but there aren't any signs that they're about to. I got various, and lots of people got various messages in the 60s that were important to our own liberation, even though they weren't addressed directly at us. And I'm thinking of women here as well as gays. With the message I got from the black movement, subliminal, was, you know, it's not only okay to be different, it's wonderful to be different. You know, black is beautiful. Black is not second rate or second class, and you don't have to be a carbon copy middle class white in order to think well of yourself. And then the message I got, you know, during the anti-war movement from the student radicals was, don't trust the experts. The experts got us into Vietnam. And that message applied across the board. I mean, challenge all institutional authority, all received wisdom. So you put those two together, it's okay to be different, and the experts usually don't know what the hell they're talking about. And finally, you begin to realize that maybe you're okay, and maybe you ought to start asserting your differentness instead of apologizing for it.
When you were first exposed to the gay liberation movement in the 60s, were you skeptical of it?
I was, yeah. I was. I mean, it was kind of double vision. I mean, I was attracted and I was appalled all at once. I began to reach out once therapy ended. I reached out to a gay liberation front consciousness raising group. I stayed for one whole session. I decided, you know, the people weren't serious enough or smart enough, or, you know, you can always sandbag yourself in these ways. And then next I went to Gay Academic, Gay Activist Alliance, and I took part in some sessions for beginners. I was already 42 years old, and most of the people in the room were in their early 20s. But nonetheless, in a real sense, I was a novice. And I needed to begin at the beginning. And then after a while, the change was quick. I'd always had a rebellious side, fortunately, and a lot of doubts had accumulated in me. And as I say in the book, once I punched through the wall really did seem paper thin. And so quickly thereafter, I became, you know, I sat on the first organizing board of Lambda Legal Defense. I was on the originating board of the National Gay Task Force, all this by 72 or 73, and also I was one of the founders of the Gay Academic Union. So once the momentum began, it did quickly accelerate.
Were there any risks to you professionally in coming out?
I was pretty well protected by the time I came out. I had tenure. I had a long list of publications. I've never suffered that kind of overt discrimination as a result of coming out, though lots of people do. I want to emphasize that because mine was a very privileged position. Nonetheless, I have suffered some subtle kinds of discrimination. For example, I used to be invited to write for, you know, broad range of publications on a broad range of social issues. Once I came out, I was pigeonholed as a gay polemicist. And it was widely assumed that I no longer had anything of relevance to say on any issue other than homosexuality. So I stopped getting those invitations.
I wonder if you think that there's a lot that people who are heterosexual have to learn from hearing the stories of gays and lesbians and how they've lived their lives and how they've come out and how they relate to gender. In other words, if you think that there's things that heterosexuals can really learn about sex and gender by hearing the stories of people who are different from them.
Yeah, I think I think the lessons that are not only critical, but I think this conformist culture desperately needs to hear them, the messages. For example, I mean, in the last 5 years, 10 years, we've seen the emergence of gay lesbian studies on the campuses. You know, it's a burgeoning movement that's developing very rapidly. And the data that has already emerged from gay lesbian studies, I feel, has an enormous amount to say to everybody, regardless of their orientation. To give just a few examples, the emerging information about gays and lesbians tells all of us a lot about the artificiality of standard gender roles. It also tells us a lot about the connection between gender and sexuality. Lesbian women, for example, are far less willing to take on, you know, the traditional pretense that women are not sexual. They are decidedly pushing the boundaries of female sexuality, and that's useful information for all women. And also, the new information has a lot to say about how anybody forms an identity, how people form identities in common, what we call subcultures or communities, how those subcultures influence the mainstream. I think critical and unique data is emerging from gay lesbian studies and gay lesbian lives. I'm not terribly confident that the mainstream, you know, will listen to the information, but I certainly think they could profit from it.
Martin Duberman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Martin Duberman recorded in 1991 after the publication of his memoir, Cures. His latest book, Midlife Queer, follows his story into the 70s. Coming up, comic Leah Delaria. This is Fresh Air. On today's program, we've heard a lot of stories about what it was like to be gay before the gay rights movement. Leah Delaria is a comic whose in-your-face humor could only have happened after Stonewall. Delaria made a bit of TV history a few years ago on the Arsenio Hall show when she became the first out-of-the-closet lesbian comic on late-night TV to do stand-up about being a lesbian. In that performance, she talked about how she expected her mother to react.
And I know exactly what she's going to say. She's going to go, why do you have to say you're a homosexual on national TV like that? Why do you have to do that? Why do you have to say that? I mean, everyone heard you. The neighbors heard you. The priests heard you. Everyone heard you. I can't believe, and it's bad enough you have to say you're a homosexual, but why do you have to call yourself a dyke? That's such an ugly, mean, nasty word, that word dyke. It's a terrible, nasty, mean, ugly word, that word dyke. I just hate that word. It's a terrible, nasty, mean, awful, ugly, terrible, ugly. Oh, wouldn't you rather be a nice lesbian? Lesbian, okay? I can't call myself lesbian. I can't use that word. I hate that word. It's such a technical, clinical word, isn't it? Isn't it? It's like, it sounds like someone you call to repair things in your home, doesn't it? It's like, honey, the refrigerator's on the fritz. Ready to get the lesbian. Can't do it. And I won't call myself a homosexual either. Ugh, because that would be gross. It would be gross. I think of that word homosexual much like I think of the word Negro. You know what I mean? It's like, let's go down to the river and sing some old homosexual spirituals. Somewhere.
So listen, was your mother really upset about you saying you were a dyke on national TV? And was she even more upset by saying that you said that she was upset?
I warned her. I called her and told her I was going to say that. But you know, I have to tell you, Terry, I was raised in an Italian Catholic family, okay, which makes it very difficult to be queer because Italians believe that, you know, not Italians, but Catholics believe that if you ignore something, It'll go away. It'll disappear, okay? So when I came out to my parents, you know, we did the whole, like, we did the screaming, the fighting, the yelling, the throwing things, you know, that Italians do, and then they just forgot about it, you know? So we would have to do it, like, every month, you know? It's like, I have to do it again and again and again and again. They keep bringing men home for me to, you know, strange men. They bring them into the house, you know, like, Leah, meet Bob. I'd be like, what is this? Remember that conversation we had last month? You throw a dinette through the window. You remember that? It's like, I am not interested in Bob, okay? So the whole dyke thing, we've been going through this for years, you know what I mean? And since I've been standing on stage for, what, 10, 11 years now, talking about being a lesbian, and a dyke is my word of choice, talking about that, my mom and dad have started to mellow into it a little bit more. I have to say that doing like The World According to Us for PBS last year, being on 2020 last year, but now definitely being on the Arsenio Hall show has made all the difference. You know what I mean? There's a certain sort of validation that you get from the media, and it helps your little old Italian straight parents get it a little better.
Mm-hmm. My daughter may be a dyke, but she's a dyke on national TV.
Thank you very much.
Leah Delaria, recorded in 1993. We end our show today with a song by Billy Strayhorn, the longtime arranger and composer with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. A recent biography of Strayhorn describes his life as a gay man in the jazz world. Here's Ella Fitzgerald with the Duke Ellington Orchestra singing Something to Live For. I'm Terry Gross.
I have almost everything a human could desire. Cars and houses, bearskin rugs to lie before my fire. But there's something missing. Something isn't there. It seems I'm never kissing the one whom I could care for.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Crown Publishing Group, publisher of The Genesis of Ethics, How the Dysfunctional Family of Genesis Leads Us to Moral Development, by theologian Burton L. Vysotsky. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Waylon Jennings tells us how he helped start the outlaw movement in country music. He's written his autobiography. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
There's a road in Oklahoma, straighter than a preacher, longer than a memory, and it goes.